Our guest today is author extraordinaire Lawrence Weschler. Thank you for joining
us. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're here. You are a very brilliant and gifted writer. You were with the New Yorker for 20 years. Mm-hmm. You've written for the New York Review of Books, many other magazines, but also tell us a little some of your other more administrative projects.
Well, I was indeed at the New Yorker for 20 years. I quit about 10 years ago to become the head of the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU. And at the same time, for the last 5 years, I've been running the Chicago Humanities Festival. I've been the artistic director there. I'm just retiring from that. But anyway, I'm also contributing editor at McSweeney's. I'm a curator at their DVD quarterly, Wolfen. I'm a contributing editor at Three Penny Review, Virginia Quarterly Review, various places. But so I have different hats and different mischief.
And under those hats is quite the brain who has received many, many awards. You got 2 Polk Awards for cultural reporting and magazine reporting, the Land and Literary Award, mm-hmm. and your books have gotten wonderful awards. But I'd like to say that The Atlantic, in describing you, said that your entire body of work contains the disquieting strangeness that lurks at the heart of human experience.
Well,
yeah. So your books.
My friend Ian Fraser said, the wonder of everything that can't be known for sure.
That is wonderful.
But anyway.
Your books cannot be categorized. You call them creative nonfiction, but let's just go through. I want our audience to see some of these. I love this book, Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonder. Absolutely delightful. We'll talk about it more later. Secondly, and it, well, by the way, got the you were a finalist for the National Book Critics Award, and also you were shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize
for that book. Yeah.
This one also, Everything That Rises, a book of convergences, National Critics Award finalist. Look at the title of this. Seeing is forgetting the name of the thing one sees. This is based on 30 years of conversations with the artist Robert Irwin.
Right.
And then 25 years of conversations with David Hockney. This one is called True to Life. And soon we'll be celebrating the release of a new book that's not out yet called Uncanny Valley, Adventures in the Narrative.
Yep.
So you've been busy. But when you say you go to a bookstore to find your books, and what you found, Mr. Wilson, in psychedelia?
Well, what happens with my books is interesting, and it's an interesting problem I have with bookstores. I think of my writing, when I teach a course in doing this kind of writing, I call it writerly nonfiction, mm-hmm. which is to say nonfiction in which you write as though the reading mattered, and you read as if the writing mattered. And there's a bunch of us who do that. And it seems to me that the proper place to put us is under literature. I mean, where they put other pieces of writing. But instead, in most bookstores in nonfiction, they do it by topic, or they spread it out.
Yeah.
And a lot of my stuff, precisely, nobody knows where to put. So that Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonder, which was a portrait of the Museum of Jurassic Technology in Los Angeles, which is a real place. My favorite description of it, somebody reviewed it as a work of magic realist nonfiction.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Because you don't really know where you stand with it as you're reading it, which is much of what happens when you go to the museum in Culver City. But the result is that it ends up being a meditation on, or there's a series of trapdoors in the text, and I like that feeling of vertigo where suddenly everything falls away and you don't know quite where you are. But it ends up being a meditation on museumship, on the history of museums, on what museums mean, where they came from. And it goes all the way back to the origins of museums and wonder cabinets. But try to explain that to a bookseller, and it ends up in New Age books and so forth. And what's frustrating to me is that, for example, that is very consciously a book that is paired with another book called Boggs, A Comedy of Values, which does for money what that book does for museums. The typeface is the same. The design is the same. But they're never side by side. The Boggs book, which is about an artist who suspends his drawings, anyway, that book is usually under economics, if anywhere. And so what happens is that the kind of connections, which is all about what my work is about, gets lost. I once had a discussion with an independent bookstore, and I said, you know, there is a bookstore that knows how to do this, alas, and it's Amazon.
Ah.
I mean, there it's all the stuff is in one place under your name, which is but they said, well, how are we supposed to do this? I said, well, you know, it's hard,
yeah.
But that's what you do. That's why you have an independent bookstore to decide, you know, what is where things should be. But
well,
anyway.
You talk about the trap doors, but in there's another way of saying it, that in Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonders, we must be led from familiar objects toward unfamiliar objects, guided along a chain of flowers into the mysteries of life. Maybe that's a little easier than the trapdoors, but it is truly trapdoors.
Well, that comes from the characterization that David Wilson, the founder of the Museum of Technology himself, has. You can be walking down the street in Culver City in Los Angeles, and I urge you to do so the next time you're there, and you'll see a Pip Printing and a carpet store and an abandoned real estate office and the Museum of Jurassic Technology and a Thai restaurant and an auto lube place and an In-N-Out Burger, and then you say, what? What was that? And you go back, and there is a storefront museum that you walk in, and it's dark inside, and it is like you fall through a trap door into like the old kind of museum with glass vitrines and oak panels and so forth, beautifully maintained, filled with stuff that's just absolutely incredible, unbelievable things, human horns, and also sorts of things where you aren't quite sure this is true. I mean, one of my favorite exhibits very early on is of protective auditory mimicry. And it shows a iridescent beetle and an iridescent stone. And the caption says, the beetle has learned to make the same sound when threatened that the stone makes at rest. And you go, huh?
Yes.
What is that? And then that I know one of your favorite things
yes,
we're talking about is,
tell us
is,
about
is
the stink
the,
ant.
You find a display, a vitrine of a diorama of the jungle. Little short, small diorama of leaves, and there's an ant with a spike coming out of its head. And this is, and you pick up the sound. There's a little phone jack, and it's the voice of institutional authority. That voice you recognize from every museum acoustic guide. And the voice says that you're looking at the Cameroonian stink ant, one of the few ants whose scream is audible to the human ear. And that these ants are very industrious in West Africa. And every once in a while, one of these ants will inadvertently inhale a spore of a fungus that's raining down from somewhere in the canopy above.
So they are naturally floor dwellers.
Well, I mean,
we don't know.
I mean, you're reading this because, and if you happen to be at ant eye level when this happened, you'd see a look of stupefaction come over the ant's face. Because indeed the spore has already lodged in its brain and begins to foment bizarre behavioral changes. For the first time in its life, the ant leaves its industrious work and starts climbing the hanging tendrils of vines and reaches a prescribed height and impales its mandibles on the vine and waits to die, because indeed the spore is eating up its entire nervous system. 2 weeks after it dies, a prong erupts from out of its forehead, heavy laden with spores, which now rain down on the forest floor for other ants to inhale. So you're listening to this and you go, okay, you put that down. And I once asked David, the founder of the museum, you know, is this true? I mean, where'd you hear about this? He says, oh, yes, I heard about it on a nature special. I said, do you have that? He said, no, we lost that. And so everything is kind of lost. You don't quite know whether it's true or not. It turns out in this case, by the way, that's entirely true. The thing about the Museum of Jurassic Technology is that everything in it, no matter how unbelievable, is true, sort of. Kind of. I mean, there's slippage happening everywhere.
Well, you even quote Mr. Wilson himself. He says his task is to reintegrate people to wonder.
Yeah. And you're wondering, you go from wondering at the marvels of nature to wondering whether this is even true. But that's the fundament of all discovery.
And that creates a shimmer.
Sure.
That resonance.
A shimmer and a shiver
right. between is it the wonder of the mysteries of life and the wonder is could this possibly.
And that's, by the way, at the heart of all science. I mean, that moment when you're doing, when you discover weirder and weirder things, you come up with strange hypotheses about it. Then the boring part is you have to nail it down and so forth, and then
duplicate it.
Yeah, right, but that first moment is at the core of human experience.
You have said that what unites your writing is that it's about people and places that catch fire. Mm-hmm. That you're talking about
people who were people or places that were just moseying along in the everydayness of their lives, and suddenly from one minute to the next caught fire, and ended up somewhere altogether different than they thought. I mean, when you see this. A lot of my writing is political. We didn't talk about that at all. And, you know, I've written about Poland and about torture
yes.
in Latin America and South Africa and Iraq and Bosnia and so forth. But what a lot of those places have in common is that suddenly the places caught fire and people took off and people became very active. When I was covering Solidarity, they used to speak of Solidarity as an expression of the subjectivity of the Polish nation. Which meant its capacity to act as the subject of history instead of the object of history. That Poland had always been the object of other people's histories, and now suddenly they were insisting on being the subject of their own history. It's a grammatical transformation. And that's true all over the place in the Middle East right now, the Egyptian
yeah.
Spring and so forth. What happens when repression happens is you're taking people who've started acting like subjects and trying to turn them back into objects. And resistance is the refusal to have that happen. So that's on the political side. But it can also happen in individuals' lives. And when it happens in individual lives, David Wilson or some of the other people I profile, Boggs, this money artist, who suddenly completely goes off the rails. That, by the way, is the origin of the word delirium, is to go off the road.
Delirium.
Delirium. Today, lyric. And people who become, in a certain sense, off the rails, it can be very funny and also very profound. And so my work goes back and forth between those kinds of themes. But the theme that they have in common is indeed people catching fire.
This other award-winning and very popular, fascinating book is called Everything That Rises, A Book of Convergences. I know Flannery O'Connor had the short story called Everything That Rises Must
Converge. Exactly.
And I've heard that that is actually a resonance of Teilhard de Chardin.
Exactly. She got that from him. And in my case, what I'd been doing, there's a whole part of my work, which is where I from that free associative craziness, my loose synapses, I tend to often see things matching up that you wouldn't otherwise necessarily see, think of. At one point, for example, Jackson Pollock paintings from 1952, and then you look at Time Life books of galaxies in collision, and it's exactly the same imagery from 1952. The origin of this for me, in some sense, or the thing that gave me permission to do it, is that John Berger, the great, great grandfather of us all, the man who did the film Ways of Seeing in response to Kenneth Clark's Civilization series. He's my great master. But he, years ago, at the time that Che was killed, you remember that incredible photograph of Che?
Well, let's just actually take a moment
and look at it.
So
that when people first saw that photograph of Che, many pictures were taken that day of Che's corpse laid out in front of the generals who'd captured him. But that was the picture that every newspaper used. And John Berger shortly after wrote a piece where he said, we all know what this photograph is based on. The image that was hot-wired in people's brains that taught the generals where to stand and taught the photographer where to take the picture from. This is obviously based on Rembrandt's anatomy lesson.
And so we'll look at Rembrandt's anatomy lesson.
And I remember reading that and saying to myself, this guy looks at the newspaper differently than I look at the newspaper. This is a very interesting way to look at the newspaper. And it becomes extremely interesting because, in turn, Rembrandt's anatomy lesson clearly is referring to many images of the deposition of Christ, such as Mantegna's famous image where you see the feet and up front. And that, in turn, helps you understand why you see those pictures all over the place. The Che t-shirts. I mean,
yes.
This has nothing to do with the politics. This is just the way in which pictures prepare the way for other pictures, that we see the world constantly in terms of all the things we've already seen. So that when you see that picture of Che, you have that association, even subliminally, to Rembrandt, and through Rembrandt back to the Christ story. And then suddenly Che becomes martyred in a particular way, and there's a resurrection in the life, and you suddenly see those t-shirts all over the place. I talk about the way that if Che had been clean-shaven that day, and I have a show a photograph of a guy who's clean-shaven, none of this would have happened. You wouldn't have had that resonance, and that photograph turns out to be a picture of Che himself in disguise as an Argentinian businessman on his way to the for his passport photo on the way to Africa. But it's absolutely clear to me that it is of the essence of the cult of Che that he is a Christian figure because of the way he was photographed and so forth. And that happens over and over again, and it's something I just like to think about a lot.
Let's look at the train. One is by Magritte, and one is a photograph from about when?
Okay, so the painting by Magritte, I think, is 1938, the painting is called Le Temps Duré, Time, Duration of Time, and the other is a photograph, which I'm sure Magritte was aware of a very famous incident in 1895, I think it's 1895, when a train overshot the station in Paris. What happens is you look at those two, I say to myself, I'm sure that Magritte must have been aware of that. But then you can take it further, because all kinds of things begin to happen. With Magritte, the idea of doing a picture of a train and calling it Le Temps Duré means that he's referring back to Einstein, who in the theory of relativity, in 1906, all of his examples are about trains, that
yes,
lightning
yeah.
hits a train track, and what does it mean to be uh-huh. simultaneous and so forth. But that in turn goes back to 1886, when Einstein would have been 6 years old. And all anybody was talking about in 1886 was simultaneity for the following reason. It used to be that time was real, that Santa Fe and Albuquerque and so forth kept real time, and that was fine. Which is to say that time in Santa Fe might have been 18 minutes different from time in Las Vegas, based on when noon was, mm-hmm. when actual noon happened. But that was no problem until you had trains going transcontinentally. It is absolutely the case that trains in 1870 going from New York to Chicago had to have 17 clocks on board, because the clock for every town they stopped in, it was all different. And so a world conference was held in 1884, to establish time zones. That's when you have time zones, and that's why it only matters, because you have trains to get things, so you don't have this complete chaos. And the vote was 42-1. It was the Treaty of Washington. One country demurred. The Treaty of Washington said that Greenwich would be 0 degrees in London.
Greenwich, London, yeah.
Paris refused to be part of that. Paris insisted on being that 0 degrees went through the astronomical observatory in Paris. And the result was that Paris kept different time than London did. And I like to think that the trouble with that train was it was following the wrong clock and just overshot the thing. But the thing is, that think about a six-year-old prodigy who's hearing all this discussion about what time is it in London, what time is it in Paris,
yeah.
It's relative to each other, is it simultaneous? And you can see why some years later he would invent the theory, or he would come upon the theory of relativity.
And could you translate the title of Magritte's painting?
Le Temps Duré is the duration of time, or the ongoingness of time. It's okay, there's a Bergsonian quality to it, but in any case, the idea of linking time to a train is completely Einsteinian, which in turn is, at some level, why that train crashed in the first place.
Yeah.
I should say that when we published that book at McSweeney's, published it 4 years ago now, we started a contest online, and your people can go online. If you look up Convergence Contest, and you'll see 70 entries that I've been judging for the last 3 or 4 years where people send in their own examples.
Well, one of them that really struck my mind, and we're running out of time, and I really want to get this in, you had told me that plagiarism is one of the links in that chain, and that Helen Keller,
oh, yeah.
was actually sued for plagiarism.
Yeah, you get all these scandals, but often in complete good faith, people say, I had no idea I was doing it. Words are so powerful that they, so forth. But in any case, at the far extreme is plagiarism. And you have the remarkable story of Helen Keller, who publishes Story of My Life, this wonderful autobiography. I think it's 1903, something like that. And a few months later, gets accused of plagiarism. Let me repeat that. Helen Keller gets accused of plagiarism. But if you think about it, actually makes sense, because all of Helen Keller's experience of the world, she was blind and deaf, had been mediated through words, either in hand gestures or in Braille. So that would, for example, if she went to the Matterhorn and saw the Matterhorn, her experience would have been the Braille version of the Baedeker. That would have been paragraphs describing, and that would have been her actual experience. Yeah. So that years later, when she recalled her experience, she might well have paragraphs, she had wonderful memory, that were, quote, plagiarized. Anyway, she was devastated by this. And the wonderful thing is that Mark Twain, bless his heart, sent her a letter, just this exquisite letter, and I urge your listeners to just go on Google and look up Helen Keller, Mark Twain, plagiarism. And he basically said, oh, how owlishly idiotic was this whole plagiarism farce. As if there was ever any human utterance except plagiarism. Every human utterance is based on things that were said before. And he gives this great, great thing. And that, in a way, is how culture works. That we are in a bath of prior references. And what the Book of Convergences ends up being is a kind of theory of cultural transition, how everything we experience takes place in the context of stuff we've already experienced. A friend of mine has this great line, and she told me one day that she couldn't remember who said it. She thought it might be Ezra Pound. But that culture begins when we forget our sources. Isn't that a great line?
Oh, that's wonderful. We have a minute left. You say that we're narrative-seeking creatures and that our brains secrete stories. You talk about how you can work and work and work at writing a story or finding convergences, but there's an element of grace. Let's close on that note of grace. What does grace mean to you?
Well, I just say that every writer has had this experience, but every creative person has it, and for that matter, anybody in the middle of their day has it, which is that you work and you work and you work at something that then happens by itself. And it wouldn't have happened without all that prior work, which is preparation for receptivity in a way. But the work doesn't cause it to happen. It's not like it doesn't, there's all that work and there's something more, which is for free. And grace, the word grace, comes from gratis, for free. And that experience of grace, and this is completely independent of any religious context, although religion has a lot to do with it also, is this experience that creative people have all the time, that all of us have, that at a certain point it's just right. There's a rightness that descends for free, and on the religion side, I like to think that God created man because he loves stories. We created God because we love the gods because we love stories, but they return the favor and of the essence, as you indicated, is this thing that in the same way that our bile secretes, our gallbladder secretes bile, our pancreas secretes insulin, our brains secrete narrative. Secret stories.
Well, we've come to the end of our time, and I have to thank you for sharing your narrative through all of these wonderful books. Quickly, Everything That Rises Must Converge, and Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonders. I want to thank you, our guest, Lawrence Weschler, for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our guest today is Lawrence Weschler. Thank you for joining us.
I'm great to be back.
Well, we are celebrating the launch of your latest book called Uncanny Valley, Adventures in the Narrative. So thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
You're one of my favorite writers. I want you to tell us a little about your background. We'll look at some of your books, and then we'll launch into Uncanny Valley.
Okay. I grew up in California, went to school at Santa Cruz, eventually was a staff writer at The New Yorker for over 20 years, and I shuttled between, as I used to say, political tragedies and cultural comedies. Yeah. And I was there until 10 years ago. I quit to become the director of the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU. I also am the artistic director, was until just recently, of the Chicago Humanities Festival. So I get to kind of be an impresario. A friend of mine did a portrait of me, which he entitled "The P.T. Barnum of the Mind." So,
oh, lovely! Well,
so anyway, but when I'm not impresarioing, I'm actually, or I impresario in another way, which is I write and have about a dozen books and various awards and so forth. The theme of the books overwhelmingly are, I call them passion pieces, because they're about people who just catch fire, people who or places for that matter. I mean, the political pieces are about, you know, uprisings and attempts to put down uprisings and attempts to keep from being put down and so forth. So over the years, I've had all sorts of different writing. This newest book is a collection, which is the – a lot of my books are paired together, and so this one is paired with a book that some of your readers might know called Vermeer in Bosnia, and this is the follow-up of that book. And in both cases, they are thematically coherent collections, but they have all kinds of different sorts of things in them.
Well, we'll come back. I only have one half of several of these pairs. When you talk about being the P.T. Barnum of the mind, I want to talk about the book that won you so many prizes and catapulted you to people's attention. This is a wonderful book, Mr. Wilson's Cabinet of Wonder.
About the Museum of Jurassic Technology in Los Angeles, in Culver City.
It's paired with a book called...
Boggs, A Comedy of Values, about an artist named Boggs, who, in both cases, these are kind of Socratic enterprises. These are both artists, David Wilson with his museum and Boggs with money, who kind of take you from the dailiness of your own life and kind of open up trapdoors. In the case of Boggs, he was a artist who drew money and spent his drawings. And this creates all kinds of problems when you draw a $100 bill and then try to spend it. There are a lot of people who want to buy the bills. He will not sell them. He will only spend them. But this creates havoc everywhere, including with Secret Service of all different kinds of countries. And so that's a fun thing about the comedy of why we value things at all. So.
And then you have this book, Everything That Rises, a book of convergences that has its own juxtapositions. We've already done a show about this, and so we won't dwell on it, but it is a wonderful and definitely a prize-winning book.
And that will have a follow-up book, which I can come back to in a few years when I do that, but Everything That Rises, the follow-up, will be called All That Is Solid. Anyway.
Another pair of resonances, because these have just come out again. Yeah. It's, a pairing of two absolutely pivotal 20th century American artists. One is Robert Irwin, the California artist, and I love the title of this book. You can say it.
It's Seeing is Forgetting the Name of the Thing One Sees. And this is a book, this was actually my first book, although this is a new edition, which is much amplified, but when I first published this book, it was about this artist, Robert Irwin, who went on to be the first artist to win a MacArthur. He is, without doubt, one of the 10 most influential artists in America, the one you might have heard of least, because he often would not allow his work to be photographed.
But didn't it say that he's turned more people, inspired more?
Well, there's a funny line, a review of the book, a blurb where Michael Govan, the head of the LA County Museum of Art, says this book, and I think it's actually true, has inspired more young people to become artists than the Velvet Underground inspired people to become rockers. And it is the case that many, many young art students will refer to this book. I mean, Irwin is an incredibly articulate fellow who started as a figurative painter and systematically dismantled his activity till he got to the point where he was basically in an empty room. He got rid of line, of figuration, of any association. He got rid of focus. He got rid of galleries, and eventually was doing work that was completely outside in the world. He then came out the other end and did some of the biggest projects of our time. He did the Getty Garden, the Garden at the Getty. He did Dia Beacon. But in any case, the story is one. It was very, very. He's very argumentative and very, very convinced that what he's doing is right. And when that book came out, the original book, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, I guess, I got a call from David Hockney, who said, I've been reading this book. I disagree with everything in it, but I can't stop thinking about it. Why don't you come over and we'll talk about it? And I did. And this was the point when David Hockney was first doing those photo collages, those Polaroid photos. And he asked me to do the text for that book, that big square book that came out some years ago. And I did. And that essay turned out to be a refutation of the Irwin book. Irwin went on to, so the book, this becomes the first chapter in this book, True to Life.
Let me just show this. Yeah. This is the Hockney book based on 25 years of conversations.
And so what happened is that Hockney basically savaged the Irwin position in that essay that I did with him. And Irwin read that and said, not true. And then I did another essay about Irwin for a retrospective. Hockney read that and said, not true. And the two of them have been having this fundamentally interesting argument. I mean, it's not personality driven. For 25 years.
But you are the liaison.
Well, the point is they've never spoken to each other.
Ah.
So this is 25 years of a principled discussion about what you would do. In both cases, they think that cubism is the most important thing that happened in the 20th century. It's not just an art movement, and it's not over. And its implications are not over, and they are both convinced that if you were taking it seriously, you would be doing what they are doing and not what the other one is doing.
But they see two different functions for cubism.
Yeah,
they
have
completely
opposite ideas. Yeah, yeah. Except that what's really funny, if they could hear each other, is that they are concerned about very much the same sorts of things. And the cubism as a critique of the perils of which into which our society has fallen. And that it matters how you look at the world, and they are very passionate in their arguments. So anyway, that's what that ends up being.
And I don't know how you have time to write all these, but we are celebrating now the launch of your newest book, Uncanny Valley: Adventures in the Narrative. So tell us about this book.
Well, it begins.
What is?
It's a collection, but it's a collection of work of the last 10, 15 years, but. So that a lot of people who know my work, primarily from The New Yorker, this is all new stuff, and much of it has been published in out-of-the-way places.
We forgot to mention, 20 years you were writing for The New Yorker.
The New Yorker. But so most of this stuff did not appear in The New Yorker. So there are people who have been wondering what I've been up to, and this is what I've been up to. And so it's thematically collected. There's a whole section, for example, on probes into the terrain of human rights. There's a collaboration I did with Richard Avedon. There's my coverage of the creation of the International Criminal Court, coverage of Rwanda, places like that. So there's that section. But then there's other pieces as well. And the title piece is called Uncanny Valley. And it is a piece that I wrote 6 or 7 years ago, I guess 8 years ago, for Wired magazine about the digital animation of the face, which turned out to be a really interesting subject because digital animators have gotten better and better and better. They can do crowds that are completely believable. They can do hands. They can do people. They can do Quidditch matches.
Yes,
in Harry Potter.
They
can do, and they are completely credible. They can do people walking down the street, completely credible. They cannot do faces. They have hit a wall with faces. And there is an ongoing discussion whether it's even conceptually possible to do a digital version of a face. This becomes very interesting why that might be the case. But one of the things about it is we say that the face is the seat of the soul. I'm looking at your face, and I am aware, I spend most of my life looking at faces, and I become really, really, really sensitive to the slightest thing being wrong. So that when people are doing digital animation, they get better and better and better, but if anything's wrong, it just... which doesn't happen if a person walking, you're willing to give a little.
Yeah.
The concept that is at the center of this discussion among digital animators, and I'm talking about the people who do Shrek and Avatar and all kinds of things, but the central concept is the Uncanny Valley. And this was a concept that was enunciated originally by Masahiro Mori, who is a Japanese Buddhist roboticist. And he had this notion that if you were making a robot that was 80% lifelike, that was fantastic. 90% even better. 95% ecstasy. 96% was a disaster because you had fallen into the uncanny valley, which is to say that up to that point, you are making something, a robot that is more and more lifelike. Suddenly, you cross into an abyss where you're making a human being that has something wrong with it, and it's creepy, and there's something uncanny, there's something unsettling, distinctly unsettling.
But people also register this very unconsciously. Children will start crying.
Well, so what's interesting about what's interesting about the uncanny valley among when you're doing the body is you can get out of it on the other side. But when you're doing faces, we are so sensitive to what is right about a face that if you make a face that is 98% accurate, 99% accurate, it's a catastrophe. You can make it 99.99999% accurate, and we are so sensitive to things wrong in a face that it just is creepy. So indeed, for example, with Shrek 3, there's two ways, by the way, of animating faces. There's one where they do those dots, you know, that's called motion capture.
And which they did with Avatar, right?
Avatar. Yeah. The other way is where they build a digital anatomy. So they have bone structure. It's all zeros and ones, but they have muscles moving, and they can, you know, can puppeteer-like, they can move them. Shrek has done that way. And they've gotten better and better, and they were so pleased with how good they'd gotten with Princess Fiona in Shrek 3. And they showed it to a group of five-year-olds who freaked out. And they had fallen into the uncanny valley. It was very creepy. And so they had to literally dial back from what they're able to do. There's a whole discussion about whether they've been able to cross it. And one of the people I talked to in the book, for example, is one of my favorite people, was this Danish full professor at Stanford whose life work is animating a glass of milk. A glass of milk with a digital light source, a virtual light source moving around it. And he points out that if you do plastic, that's very easy. If you do dinosaur hide, that's very easy. If you do insect carapaces, that's easy, which is why you get Toy Story and Dinosaur and so on and so on. Because that's basically just Newtonian physics, light bounces. Well, if you do a glass of milk, light enters the glass, bounces around in quantum fashion, and comes out at completely odd angles. And to make it believable, you can do dinosaur on a laptop. You need a supercomputer. You need a bank of supercomputers to be able to do milk. The reason that matters, by the way, is because that's skim milk is exactly the way the whites of your eyes work.
Hmm.
And if you just have the whites of your eyes not working, that's a disaster. But as he says, dinosaurs are easy. Milk is hard. And by the way, one of the things that's fascinating with this whole technique is that, this is an odd thing, when they finally do digitally animate a face, or the ones that are easier to animate turn out to be black people, people of color, because light bounces off of black skin more Newtonian fashion, whereas off of white skin it has more of that quality of milk and is more problematic. When James Cameron can't claim that he had crossed the uncanny valley, which was one of his big boasts, he's cheating because on the one hand, he's got dealing with aliens
right.
who had blue makeup, which was easy, that was Newtonian, but also you were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt because they were aliens. So if you felt creeped out by them, that was fine because they were aliens. The gold standard will be if you can make a human being out of zeros and ones that looks like a human being that fools you. And I would bet they'll never get there.
Can you give us in brief the trajectory of the kind of graph toward the uncanny valley? Because it starts out with people and stuffed animals.
Yeah,
and
sure. I mean, earlier stuff is
zombies.
But as you get closer and closer, it's more and more lifelike. But what happens when you get to let's say, 95, it's an arbitrary number, 95%, 96%. But from one moment to the next, something that was getting more and more satisfying becomes horrifying, becomes really unsettling. And what we say is it's entered the uncanny valley because, as I say, it's gone from being a robot, which we realize is a robot that's really lifelike, that's really cool, to being a human being that is trying to put something over on us. But so that is the beginning of the book. I then have various sections. I have short pieces. I have a piece about when Dario Fo, the great playwright from Italy, came to America, was only allowed to come for 3 days. This is during the Reagan administration because he was supposedly a communist. And he wanted to see all the plays on Broadway.
Oh.
And he and I did a walkabout where we saw 10 plays in 2 hours. And it was just really a wonderful thing to do. And so I have stories like that. I have a story that some of you people here in Santa Fe might remember, that show of The Art of the Disappeared.
That was a phenomenal
was
show,
an
unforgettable show.
Show of Latin American artists dealing with the dirty wars. And I had been invited by the North Dakota Museum of Art to come and see it when it first opened. I couldn't, and I just went thinking, you know, well, I go where I don't haven't been, but I wasn't expecting much. They put together really one of the great shows of the year that year. And I contacted the people at the Lannan Foundation, and I said, you better come up here and look at this. And they did, and then they paid to tour that show around the world, all over Latin America, and to, among other places, Santa Fe. I wrote the catalog essay, and the catalog essay is collected in this book.
But you're, again, this juxtaposition of incongruous items. You teach graduate students at NYU in this mm-hmm. class of what, the fiction of nonfiction.
Right.
And you say most of your students are either journalism students
well,
or
it's graduate students. Yeah, I make a point of having half the students be graduate journalism students and half the students be graduate poetry students.
And you say you're going to create a generation of?
Well, I talk about I want to create a generation of lyrical reporters and investigative poets. But what's very funny is how they have trouble talking to each other. But the class is called The Fiction of Nonfiction, and it's all about storytelling, and it's about all the parts. I mean, I take for granted in terms of nonfiction that you need to be accurate, fair, things like that. But at that point, what becomes interesting is all the fictional elements, form, structure, voice, irony, freedom,
plot, epiphany,
all that sort of thing, and narrative, storytelling, and so it's a class that, for example, I'm usually not allowed to teach in journalism programs because there's, oh my God, fiction, nonfiction, no, we know this is very bad. I start with a complete critique of objectivity. I mean, that's ridiculous. There is no such thing as objective. I insist in my writing and in my reading that the writer use the first-person voice, not out of megalomania, but out of modesty.
Hmm.
This is my view. I did my best, but I don't have the objective reality. And so it drives me crazy when I read the New York Times and it, you know, has this objective voice. And then you get these weird constructions. He asked a reporter.
Yeah.
No, he asked you. Say yeah. You. Say I and so forth. But they want the institutional heaviness of objectivity, and that's a fool's errand.
The media environment today, you say they treat us like consumers instead of beings that are capable of wonder.
Yeah, well, that's generally the case more and more with magazines, with books, and frankly with you know the whole all the pipes have been set up to more efficiently take money from your pocket into the proper corporate accounts, and with little Pavlovian juicing you up with little excitement about whatever the current
scandal
is. A few months ago, the thing with the woman who had either killed her child or not, and just juicing you, and now I can expect hundreds of books on the subject. Whereas what I loved about the old New Yorker, and it's very key to my whole approach to writing, is you would, in the old New Yorker, you would, and it's true of many of the pieces in this book, you would start reading a piece, and you had no idea why you were reading it. It wasn't anything you'd already heard of. But you'd go along because of the narrative power, the energy of the narration. It was kind of fun to read, and you'd be having no idea. And about halfway through, you'd realize it was the most important thing in the world.
I have experienced that.
And I'm not talking about my own writing, but with other people's writing,
yeah.
Too, Ian Frazier, Bill Finnegan, there's
John McPhee,
Susan Sheehan, Janet Malcolm, there's a whole group of them who were quite wonderful.
Well, you talk about adventures in the narrative, the mm-hmm. subtitle mm-hmm. of your book.
Right.
What is narrative? And tell me the wonderful line about God and man.
Well, I mean, it's funny, I had a whole discussion with my publisher's counterpoint about whether it should be adventures in narrative or adventures in the narrative. And I said, no, adventures in the narrative. Remember that song, Take Your Place on the Great Mandala? You know,
yeah.
I really think of life on Earth as the narrative. And we tap into it through narrative, but it is finally, at the end of the day, the narrative, capital T, capital N, that I find wonderful. And somewhere in the book, I have the story about where I basically end up saying, which is not the first person to say it, that we invented gods because we love stories, but gods returned the favor. That God invented man because he loves stories. I think the last time I was on the show, I told you that story, my thought that you know, the bile duct the gallbladder secretes bile, the pancreas secretes insulin, the brain secretes stories. That's how we experience the world. If I tell you that I was just in Florence, Italy, you don't ask me, you know, tell me it. You say, tell me, what was it like?
Yeah, or tell me the story.
Well, what's the story with those people?
Yeah.
You know, so that's, we talk to each other that way. We experience the world that way. And I love savoring that. That's one of the great, I mean, by the way, when I say that the human face is the seat of the soul, it's the seat of storytelling. Your belly doesn't tell stories. Your thigh doesn't tell stories. In Italy, the hands tell stories.
Yeah.
But it's really the expression on your face. And in a way, souls are nothing more than stories. Stories we tell ourselves and stories that we receive from others.
And the state of grace?
Well, that is, I talk about the way, I give this example of Nicholas of Cusa, who was this wonderful medieval number mystic. And he talked about the difference between a circle and an n-sided polygon inside the circle. So in other words, a triangle, a regular triangle, a square, and so forth and so on. And some people try to get to the wholeness of the world by just adding the sides, you know. Mm. So you have a million-sided polygon, and that sure seems like a circle.
Almost.
But he says you have to make the leap, which he called the leap of faith, from the cord to the arc. And that's as hard to do from the very first time as when you're at a million. A million is actually not at all like a circle. It has a million sides. A circle only has one side.
Yeah.
And in that way, that leap can only be accomplished in grace, in the sense that you work and you work and you work at something that then happens by itself for free. And that's all that work led to it, but finally the thing that makes it happen, the thing that makes a story come alive, is something a little bit more than just the words. It's the energy and it's the grace, and that's something we all savor, we all love to be in.
And I want to thank you for making the leap of faith to be with us today.
Okay,
our guest today is Lawrence Weschler. And this book, I want all of our audience to make the leap of faith and discover Uncanny Valley Adventures in the Narrative. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.